books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host Robert Kirkwood, and coming up today we'll chat to Louise Hare about her new Canary Club mystery, Harlem After Midnight. And from the archives we'll hear about the confessions of Franny Langton from author Sarah Collins. Plus, we'll find some brand new books in the Talking Books library. All to come in today's Read On. Louise Hare was last on Read On 2 years ago, where she took us on board the Queen Mary for a transatlantic cruise with a side order of murder in her book Miss Aldridge Regrets. Well, the ship has docked in New York, and the sequel to that book, Harlem After Midnight, picked up on the same day the first book ended. We'll talk to author Louise Hare in a moment, after we hear from the audio version, narrated by Leonie Elliott.
I'd only been in the apartment for 15 minutes, but already it felt like home. The bedroom that would be mine for the next fortnight was perfect. I might never want to leave. The bed was immaculately made with blue cotton sheets and a pristine white comforter tucked into the foot. The floor made of the same sturdy varnished wood that ran through the entirety of Claudette and Lewis Linfield's home. Clean towels had been folded and placed on a navy blue velvet armchair that sat in the ideal position, in a corner close to the window where I could sit and catch the last rays of sunshine at the end of the day. Claude had even laid out a selection of her favourite books on the bedside table, to ensure I had something to read before going to sleep. She was a librarian by trade, so I suppose the habit ran deep.
"You about settled in?"
Claude Linfield had a constant, easy smile, considering that she and her husband had been complete strangers only a couple of hours earlier. I already felt that there was no place safer in the whole of New York than in this cozy apartment.
"Yes, thank you."
I moved to let her join me at the window, looking down into the street that was so different to the narrow London roads that I was used to. Wider, the buildings far taller, everything just that little bit bigger and brighter than back at home. "It's so kind of you to let me stay. I know that I could have stayed on at the hotel, but
hotels are for those without their own people," she told me. "Far as I'm concerned, you're with Will and that makes you family. He's as good as a brother to me and Lewis."
Harlem After Midnight is actually a sequel to the book Miss Aldridge Regrets. So it features the same main character of Lena Aldridge. In the first book, she is traveling from the UK to New York. And as the title might suggest to you, this second book is about her time in New York, but in Harlem specifically, and it's another murder mystery. So essentially, she's really unlucky when it comes to stumbling across murders.
Will Goodman, the reason I was in Harlem and no longer resident in the luxurious but impersonal Sherry Netherland Hotel. We'd met on the voyage over from England. A cliché of a story. I had been a passenger. He was the bandleader, playing to the rich and famous every night in the Starlight Club on the HMS Queen Mary. It had been quite the voyage, and the addition of a whirlwind romance had left my head spinning. Perhaps it was foolish to throw my lot in with a man I'd only just met. But I trusted Will. There were so many others whom I couldn't, and so when he'd offered to arrange for me to stay with friends of his, I'd agreed without a second thought.
Now, the last time you were on, you said this sequel, or the first draft at least, picked up on the same day that Miss Aldridge Regrets finished. Is that still the case?
It is, yeah. It sort of begins with a prologue, which is actually in the future. But yeah, essentially the first page of chapter one is the same day. So where the first book finishes, she's just got a train up to Harlem and that's where you meet her.
And there's actually two time periods in this book. It goes from 1908 to 1936. Did New York itself change much over those years?
It did, and a lot more than I had expected. with my limited knowledge of the period before I planned this book. So it essentially meant two lots of research, because the areas people lived in changed. So I guess even today we think of Harlem as an area where, you know, it was very popular with the African-American community. But in 1908, that wasn't the case. It was still more Jewish and Italian. And so I had to research these two different areas for my characters in finding, you know, where they would have lived, how they would have lived their lives.
Yeah, something would have happened in the interim. So tell us about the Harlem Renaissance.
Yeah, so the Harlem Renaissance, mostly it's associated with the 1920s. So it's a little bit before this book, but sort of going on into the 30s. And that was, I guess, this really sort of creative time, and a time when the sort of Black community had sort of established itself in Harlem. And you were getting this sort of a Black middle class, but also especially creative. So lots of writers and artists, and having these amazing sort of jazz parties. And I mean, it just sounds fabulous. I'm sure it was, you know, everyday life was exactly like ours today. You've got, you know, the ups and downs, but it just seemed like such an interesting period, quite intellectual and creative.
My dad went to New York in the mid-90s, and he had one thing he wanted to see in the Carnegie Hall Museum was Benny Goodman's clarinet, because he was into jazz. And it took me far longer than I want to admit that I realised each section or each chapter is named after a jazz standard of the time.
Yeah. I mean, I really enjoy jazz. I used to play clarinet. I still do a little bit, but not as often as I did as a kid. And so it was quite important to me to, A, it was kind of fun just researching, because I wanted to choose songs that would have been published that Lena herself could have sang, because she's a jazz singer. So I wanted to make sure that I, A, found stuff that came out either 1936 or prior. But it was also fun to have a playlist and sort of immerse myself in that period that way. I think with these two books, having a jazz singer, there's lots of music across both books of that period. And then my very first book was called This Lovely City. And in that book, I had a main character who played clarinet in a sort of jazz band. So yeah, I think the jazz has definitely been coming out so far. I may do have a change of direction, but it's been nice to have, I guess, a bit of myself in the books, even though the characters are very different to me.
Now, you mentioned the word planning. Does that mean you're a planner rather than a pantser?
Unfortunately, no. I'm very good at sort of super vague plans. Like, I would like to write something that is a bit like this. That's, to me, is a plan. Whereas I think real planners would be like, where's your spreadsheet? Where's your, you know, your list of what's going to happen? For me, especially in the murder mystery writing business, is a bit unusual, because I know a lot of crime writers, they need to have a plan. They need to know who did it. And very often I don't know who did it until I get to the end. So yeah, definitely not a plotter.
Yeah, because in Miss Aldridge Regrets, the murderer changed in the final draft.
Yeah, yeah. So I thought I knew what was going on with that book, and then it changed. And for Harlem After Midnight, I just didn't decide who the murderer was, because I knew what had happened the time before. So I just trusted that by the time I got to the end, I would have figured it out.
Now, did you make many trips to New York in researching the book?
Well, not for the particular book, because I was sort of writing it in the aftermath of the pandemic. It's going to be quite tricky to go, and also quite expensive. But I have been to New York 3 or 4 times in the past. So I kind of relied on those memories. And also, I think every writer's best friend, Google Earth, for looking at, you know, the layouts of the streets, in particular the brownstone buildings that would have existed at the time. Because also the problem with writing historical fiction is things change. And so things don't actually always look the way they would have in the period that you're writing about.
Now, along with jazz, another inspiration for this book was this.
Passing by Nella Larson, read by Amaka Okafor. It was the last letter in Irene Redfield's little pile of morning mail. After her other ordinary and clearly directed letters, the long envelope of thin Italian paper with its almost illegible scrawl seemed out of place and alien. And there was, too, something mysterious and slightly furtive about it. A thin, sly thing which bore no return address to betray the sender. not that she hadn't immediately known who its sender was. Some 2 years ago, she had one very like it in outward appearance, furtive, but yet in some peculiar, determined way, a little flaunting. Purple ink, foreign paper of extraordinary size. It had been, Irene noted, postmarked in New York the day before. Her brows came together in a tiny frown. The frown, however, was more from perplexity than from annoyance, though there had been in her thoughts an element of both. She was wholly unable to comprehend such an attitude towards danger, as she was sure the letter's contents would reveal, and she disliked the idea of opening and reading it. This, she reflected, was of a piece with all that she knew of Claire Kendry, stepping always on the edge of danger, always aware, but not drawing back or turning aside. Certainly not because of any alarms or feeling of outrage on the part of others. And for a swift moment, Irene Redfield seemed to see a pale, small girl sitting on a ragged blue sofa, sewing pieces of bright red cloth together, while her drunken father, a tall, powerfully built man, raged threatening up and down the shabby room, bellowing curses and making spasmodic lunges at her, which were not the less frightening because they were, for the most part, ineffectual. Sometimes he did manage to reach her, but only the fact that the child had edged herself and her poor sewing over to the farthermost corner of the sofa suggested that she was in any way perturbed by this menace to herself and her work.
That's Amaka Okafor reading From Passing by Nella Larson, available from RNIB Talking Books. How was Passing an inspiration?
So this was a book that was published during the Harlem Renaissance. So Nella Larson was one of those sort of Harlem Renaissance writers living in Harlem in that period. She was a mixed race author. Her parentage was sort of African American and Danish. And so she wrote this book about two women who are African-American, but they can pass as white. And how they've chosen to go about their lives is very different. So one of them is, you know, very involved in the Black community in Harlem and civil rights. And the other has chosen to pass as white completely, has a white husband who doesn't know her heritage and is actually quite racist. And, you know, it would be dangerous for her if he ever found out the truth. And it's sort of about a sort of friendship, but sort of, I guess they're kind of more like frenemies, and there's quite a lot of tension there, and it turns into a bit of a thriller by the end. But I just found it a fascinating book because I love books about female relationships, especially when they're a bit tricky. And I'm always a little bit interested in the idea of passing and an identity and what that does. And because my main character, Lena, is able to pass as white, I kind of wanted to play with that idea. With the setting being Harlem, it seemed like the perfect opportunity to, I guess, pay tribute to passing a little bit and just have like a kind of play around with those themes.
Yeah, because when she was on the Queen Mary, she was told to, under no circumstances, reveal that she's mixed race. But do you think it would be easier for her in New York than in London at the time?
Theoretically, yeah. But I suppose when I was thinking about putting myself into her shoes, she's never had this community before. It's always been kind of her and her father to an extent as well. But yeah, she's in this community. And I think the differences between British culture and American culture are a little bit different. And I think she sort of throws herself into this, the friends that she meets there, and they're going to the parties and so on. But I don't think she feels necessarily part of it, which is also something that I wanted to sort of bring up, the idea that just because you're supposed to be part of a community, you might not necessarily feel that you identify with everybody in that community.
Now, if we're listening to the audiobook, Lena's voice has changed ever so slightly. Why did Leonie Elliott replace Georgina Campbell?
For logistical reasons. Georgina Campbell, her career has taken off and she moved to LA, so she wasn't physically available to do the audiobook this time around. But, you know, Leonie Elliott's a brilliant actor, and I guess I felt there was a sort of connection there a little bit, because my first book, This Lovely City, was set in sort of Windrush era South London, and Leonie played the lead character in Andrea Levy's Small Island when it was at the National Theatre. which is obviously sort of set the same period, some similarities in terms of the community, the Jamaican community in London. And so I thought it was quite nice to have her. And I think she does a brilliant job. And I was lucky enough this time around, it's the first time I've been able to be present for the recording of part of the audiobook. And just hearing her sort of switch between the different accents, I was sort of sitting there listening in awe.
I've heard it can be quite a surreal experience hearing your words being read out.
Yeah, because it doesn't feel like my book. It feels like something different, which is nice. I kind of, I don't know, I think because as writers we spend so long looking for problems or trying to fix things when we're writing the books, then when you hear someone reading it, you think, oh, actually, it's not that bad.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the book from the RNMB library is the cover. Can you give us a quick description of the cover?
I can. So it is a picture mostly of a woman from the back representing Lena at a microphone. So about to perform, which is something that she does in both books. She does perform on stage. Towards the bottom of the cover, the buildings, which once you listen to the story, that'll kind of make a bit more sense. There's a lot of the scenes are set in these sort of brownstone buildings in Harlem. And then right at the bottom, you do have the sort of body of a woman. I can't tell you if she's just unconscious or if she's dead. But yeah, it's there to sort of create intrigue. The strap line across the cover is, "What secrets hide in the city that never sleeps?"
Now, it's set in the Golden Age, the 1930s. It's full of crime. Now, is that an era that's not a million miles away from today?
It is interesting because this is 1936. Hitler's in power. So there are, not so much in this book, actually, but more in Miss Aldridge's Regrets, there were a few nods to the fact that, you know, there's things going on politically. I think our current political or global situation feels quite precarious at times these days. And I think the last time we had that was probably in the 1930s. So yeah, it was very interesting researching the period and actually seeing a lot of similarities.
And finally, will we see Lena again? And is she heading to Paris?
Well, I have had an idea for Lena, which would involve her going to Paris. But at the moment, she is having a break because I'm working on something different, very different actually, which is set in 1700s London. So I'm deep in research of Georgian London, which is actually quite a fabulous period as well, with lots going on.
You all grew up around here, you and Lewis and Will. I could see a group of young boys playing down in the road, shrieking and laughing loudly, until a woman stuck her head out of a window across the street and shouted a warning for them to keep it down. Some things weren't so different from home. Claude nodded. Went to the same school, and Will and Lewis went to college together. Really? I didn't know that. Lewis was a paediatrician at the local hospital. Had Will studied medicine as well? Doctor to musician was an odd career change. Come through, Lena. I know you English love your tea, but I hope coffee will do.
Harlem After Midnight is available now in hardback, in audio, as an ebook, and it's just come out in paperback. And Louise, thank you so much.
Thank you.
If it's not out in paperback yet, the release is imminent. This Lovely City, Miss Aldridge Regrets, and Harlem After Midnight are all available in audio from RNIB Talking Books. And Louise will be back at the end of today's show with the books of her life. That mention of 1700s London reminded me of an interview with Sarah Collins about the book The Confessions of Franny Langton, which went on to become a drama on ITV. We'll hear all about that book after we find three brand new books just released and also available in the RNIB library.
We have the first in a crime series by Margaret Kirk. Shadow Man was donated to us by Orion.
By midnight, there are bodies everywhere. Her tiny flat is crammed to bursting, but people are still stumbling through the door, waving packs of Stella or Strongbow and wrapping her in cheerful, beery hugs. She doesn't remember inviting them all, doesn't recognize half of them when she stops to think about it. But so what? For the last 4 years, she's been juggling coursework with her shifts at the all-night garage, slogging away at her degree while it felt like the rest of the world was out getting laid, or legless, or both. Doing it her way, she told her parents. Standing on her own 2 feet. And they couldn't argue with that, could they?
Two brutal killings rock Inverness and bring ex-Met Detective Inspector Lucas Mallor the biggest challenge of his career. The body of the Queen of daytime TV, Maureen Murray, is discovered by her sister Anna on the morning of her wedding day. But does Anna know more about the murder than she's letting on? Police informant Kevin Ramsay's murder looks like a gangland-style execution, but what could he have stumbled into that was dangerous enough to get him violently killed? Mallor has only a couple of weeks to solve both cases while dealing with his mother's fragile mental health. But caught in a deadly game of cat and mouse, is ex-Met DI Lucas Mallor hunting one killer or two?
Even if Mum had thrown a massive wobbly at the thought of her baby girl rejecting St Andrews and choosing to study at Glasgow. But with her finals out of the way, she's officially an ex-student. So tonight, it's party time. Shed loads of booze, the flat decked out with tea lights and a joke 70s glitter ball, and all her mates from uni, ready to make a night of it. Not all of them, though, a snide little voice reminds her. Things didn't exactly go to plan there, did they? She shakes her head, swallowing the tightness in her throat. And suddenly he's there, watching her from the doorway.
Shadow Man by Margaret Kirk is read by Steve Worsley and runs for 10 hours, 37 minutes.
Recently, we added the autobiography of Christy Watson, a nurse in the NHS. It's called The Language of Kindness and was donated by Penguin Random House.
Blood samples were taken from all of us. To hold on file, the phlebotomist announced, in case you get a needle stick injury and contract HIV. We can then find out if you were HIV positive already. It was 1994, and misinformation and fear about HIV were everywhere. The phlebotomist tied a tourniquet around my arm. Are you a student nurse or a medical student? She asked. I watched the needle. The blood filling the tube and the room began to blur. Her voice sounded far away. Christy, Christy. When I came round, I was lying on the floor with my legs on the chair and the phlebotomist above me. She laughed. You okay now? I slowly got to my elbows, regaining focus. What happened? You fainted, dear. Happens. Though you might want to rethink your career.
Christy Watson was a nurse for 20 years. Taking us from birth to death, from the A&E to the mortuary, The Language of Kindness is an astonishing account of a profession defined by acts of care, compassion and kindness. In our most extreme moments when life is lived most intensely, Christy is with us. She is a guide, mentor and friend. And in these dark days of division and isolationism, she encourages us all to stretch out a hand.
20 years in nursing has taken so much from me, but has given me back even more. I want to share with you the tragedies and joys of a remarkable career. Come with me, on the wards, from birth to death, past the special care baby unit and the double doors to the medical ward. Run through the corridors to answer the crash bleep, past the pharmacy and staff kitchen, and to accident and emergency. We will explore the hospital itself, as well as nursing, in many of its aspects. What I thought nursing involved when I started, chemistry, biology, physics, pharmacology and anatomy, and what I now know to be the truth of nursing, philosophy, psychology, art, ethics and politics. We will meet people on the way, patients, relatives and staff, people you may recognise already, because we are all nursed at some point in our lives. We are all nurses.
The Language of Kindness by Christy Watson is read by the author and runs for 9 hours.
New from Thomas Keneally, we have Fanatic Heart, which was donated by Faber and Faber.
Jenny Verner realised now what many might have spoken behind their hands about her when she was a child, for she knew she was illegitimate, one way or another. Common people used a crasser, harsher word for it. She understood later the conversations people had under their breath when she hid in corridors to overhear them. Further, there was a story about her father, who had married her, by all accounts, beautiful mother, when she was carrying a child from another man, and people thought that very good of him, but their mouths took on tucks that proclaimed him unworldly. And now the topic was, who would marry the eldest of their children, the girl Jenny? Strangely, since they would say she was a beautiful little thing, just like her mother, and it would be false modesty on her part, she realised, to say she was not. Her parents were both considered handsome, and apparently respectable in every regard. It was only later in life that members of the wider family of the Verners let her know that her parents, in fact, had not so much as married, and that Burke's peerage told the world that anyhow, or at least told anyone interested enough to look her father up.
Summer, 1847. People are getting used to the corpses lying by the road and along the ditches. For John Mitchell, lawyer, journalist, activist, politician, the word famine will forever conjure the hollowed faces of Ireland's dead, the liquid Irish of the past now mute on their tongues. Propelled by disgust at the injustice, Mitchell will do all he can to fight for the destitute, the starved, the forgotten. His odyssey will take him all the way to America, that land of promise, but it will draw him into a terrible paradox, blurring the lines that divide liberation from dispossession and forcing him to ask, can one act of devastating cruelty and oppression prevent another?
James Verner had been a captain in the British Army and resided in the Churchill mansion, where he had fallen for the coachman's daughter, Mary. Mary was now James Verner's companion there at 52 Queen Street, Newry, and had been for decades upon decades. And not wed. Who indeed, consulting Burke's peerage, as reputable people did, would marry her, Jenny Verner? Once she had even heard her own mother ask the question in lamentation. The problem itself asking about the problem. It seems her father would have been Baron Churchill of Armagh if, as the eldest of the Verners, he had married properly.
Fantastic Heart by Thomas Keneally is read by David Trednick and runs for 14 hours, 47 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Enjoy your favourite talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Start your day with a morning adventure every weekday from 8 a.m.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
A book for the younger listener or young at heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
And our usual talking book slot every weekday at 2 p.m. or if you prefer a book at bedtime, it's repeated at 10 p.m. And you'll find many episodes online at rnibconnectradio.org.uk.
I think the whole talking book scheme, in whatever form it is absolutely fantastic.
Joanna Trollope on the RNIB Talking Book Service.
I think in this day and age, modern medicine is so clever and so sophisticated, and we spend an enormous amount of time and energy and enthusiasm saving lives. But what the talking books do, and what the RNIB, I think, does in general, is save sanities before you know you get to the end of your life. The number of people whose lives have been transformed by talking books. I mean, the number of people who are visually impaired or blind who say that their lives have been absolutely changed. This is a lifeline. It's impossible to emphasize how important that is.
Now it's time to enter the Read On archive. The winner of the Costa First Novel Award was The Confessions of Franny Langton by Sarah Collins, following the fortunes of a Jamaican maid in Georgian London and inspired by Sarah's love of Gothic fiction. She'll join me in a moment, but first let's hear a clip. The audiobook is read by Sarah herself, along with Roy Macmillan.
My trial starts the way my life did, a squall of elbows and shoving and spit. From the prisoner's hold, they take me through the gallery, down the stairs, and past the table crawling with barristers and clerks. Around me a river of faces in flood, their mutters rising, blending with the lawyer's whispers, a noise that hums with all the spite of bees in a bush. Heads turn as I enter, every eye a skewer. I duck my head, parrot my boots, grip my hands to stop their awful trembling. It seems all of London is here, but then murder is the story this city likes best.
The book is about Franny, who is a young Jamaican woman who is brought to London in the early 19th century by her owner, John Langton, and given as a gift to a famous natural philosopher, George Benham. She's sent into Benham's household to work as a maid, but as soon as she arrives, she is struck by an instant and fierce attraction to his wife, who is an enigmatic French woman named Marguerite. And the pair of them embark on a very twisted Gothic love affair, which ends in tragedy because Benham and Marguerite are found murdered. Benham stabbed to death in his library, Marguerite in her bed with Franny lying next to her covered in blood. And so suspicion falls on Franny. She's brought to trial at the Old Bailey. And her barrister essentially says to her, you know, give me something I can save your neck with. And at his insistence, she writes her confession, which takes the form of the novel.
All of them swollen into the same mood, all of them in a stir about the sensation excited by these most ferocious murders. Those were the words of the Morning Chronicle, itself in the business of harvesting that very sensation, like an ink-black crop. I don't make a habit of reading what the broadsheets say about me, for newspapers are like a mirror I saw once in a fair near the Strand that stretched my reflection like a rack, gave me two heads, so I almost didn't know myself. If you've ever had the misfortune to be written about, you know what I mean.
She's recounting her life story, but what she's really doing is trying to convince herself as much as the reader that she couldn't have done this terrible thing, in particular that she couldn't have murdered the only person she ever loved. But the problem is that she has no memory of the incident, she claims, apart from being asleep.
Now, it's described as historical fiction, a whodunit, but at its heart, it's really a Gothic novel.
Yes, and it was my way of tapping into a kind of reading vein that I had felt very strongly connected to since my very early reading days. So I was obsessed with Gothic novels as a teenaged reader. And the books I read and reread during my early teens were the twisted Gothic romances like Wuthering Heights and Rebecca. And I really wanted to write this novel as a tribute to that early reading love, you know, way of writing the kind of novel I would have wanted to read, but putting a black woman center stage in one of those novels where I had never seen one before. And it was also a very deliberate tribute to Jane Eyre, which is one of my all-time reading loves. While I've been on book tour, I've taken to describing the novel as Jane Eyre if Jane had fallen in love with the madwoman in the attic and then been accused of murdering Mr. Rochester, which I think is a fate Mr. Rochester deserved, but that's probably for another discussion.
Now, Franny mentions the book she's reading, but her and yourself, you would never see yourself in any of those books.
Yes, Franny says this. She also says at some point that no one like her had ever written a novel in the history of the world. When I wrote the novel, I was very conscious of what an incredible privilege it is to be able to read and write, in particular to be able to tell stories and to put yourself into stories, and how the reality during the early 19th century would have been that someone like Franny would have been deprived of that. And part of the novel explores the price that she has to pay to, you know, to acquire this education. So growing up in the plantation, she is given certain privileges and advantages. She's brought to work inside the house. She's allowed to learn to read. And then there is this consideration of what that means for her. And she says it's the best thing and the worst thing that had ever happened to her. I really wanted to explore that, to talk about how it might feel to love books and learning so much, but to have that thing you love not quite love you back. So it opens the door for her to this world where she doesn't belong. And as a result, she experiences the kind of anger and dissatisfaction of the disenfranchised. You know, it's quite a familiar feeling, I think, to people whom history has tried to exclude and whom literature has tried to exclude.
It sort of reminded me, in a way, just in the structure of His Bloody Project, which was shortlisted for the Booker a couple of years back.
Yeah.
And the body of the text is written by the accused giving their own account.
Yes, and there are artifacts as well, so extracts from the trial. It's also a book, I suppose, that centres around a trial. Also centres around the question, not only whether or not the accused did what they did, but whether there could be any justification if they had done it. I wanted to focus very much on the trial for a number of reasons. I mean, I have a background as a lawyer, although I was a lawyer who always wanted to be a novelist. So I approached the profession in that way. But I really did want a big courthouse scene. I think, you know, courthouses are the places where some of the big dramas of life are played out. So it's no surprise that novelists kind of mine that for material. And because I was writing about, at times, quite heavy and important topics, I wanted the trial and this sense of jeopardy to provide a kind of page-turning character to the book. You know, I always think that reading should be good for us, but first and foremost, it should be pleasurable. And I wanted that feeling of anticipation and suspense that drives the reader through the novel, not that they're being taught something, but that they desperately want to know how something turns out. And so it seemed to me that having the trial and having these kind of extracts from the testimony interspersed through the novel would kind of amp up the tension, which is what I wanted.
Even those old hacks who've seen it all want a glimpse of the mulatta murderess. Even the judge stares, fat and glossy in his robes, his face soft and blank as an old potato, until he screws his eyes on me and nods at his limp-haired clerk to read the indictment.
Francis Langton, also known as Ebony Fran or Dusky Fran, is indicted for the willful murder of George Benham and Marguerite Benham, in that she, on the 27th day of January in the year of our Lord 1826, did feloniously and with malice aforethought assault George Benham and Marguerite Benham, subjects of our Lord the King, in that she did strike and stab them until they were dead, both about the upper and middle chest, their bodies having been discovered by Eustacia Linux, housekeeper of Montfort Street, London. Mr. Jessop to conduct the prosecution.
And there was a real-life inspiration in that a child was given as a gift.
Yes, so the springboard for the novel was the story of Frances Barber, which I first came across in a wonderful biography written by Michael Bundock. And Frances Barber was a young Jamaican boy who was brought to England in the middle of the 18th century and given as a gift to Samuel Johnson, you know, one of the finest minds of the age. And a couple of things surprised me and intrigued me and immediately attracted me about it, not least the fact that there were so many rich stories about black people in London, you know, in early Georgian London, and not just with the Windrush, which is a misconception, but also the idea that you could have this young, intelligent Jamaican boy rubbing shoulders with one of the finest minds of the age. And I really wanted to think about that a little bit. Usually we come at black characters in historical fiction from a different perspective. I wanted to think about what these almost familial relationships would be like. You know, as Franny says, there was love as well as hate, but the love hurt worse. So many black people in particular who were brought to London were living very, very closely with their masters and mistresses. And there was a kind of love there, but in many ways, a very destructive, one-sided love. And that was the angle I wanted to come at it from.
And were the experiments that you found out about, were they real as well?
Yes. So all of the experiments that I refer to have their roots in something that I discovered in my research. I didn't invent any of it, and I didn't want to because it was horrific enough. In fact, there were some things that were so gruesome that they had to be left out. So I allowed myself, you know, very little room for imagination there. It was all based on research, things that were recorded by real planters in the West Indies or people who were sort of journeying the earth collecting skulls and various other bits of knowledge from far-flung parts of the planet, essentially.
All taking place in your novel in a place called Paradise.
Yes, ironically called Paradise. and part of the intention behind that was to expose this hypocrisy, you know, that this was the age of the Enlightenment, and there was this sense that mankind was making more progress more quickly than it ever had done before, you know, sort of heading towards utopia. But all of that progress was being built on the backs of people who really suffered on plantations like Paradise, and their stories were either discounted or heavily edited or told with agendas or not told at all.
Now, we heard at the beginning a clip of you reading from the book. How was the recording of the audio version?
Well, I do sort of jokingly say now that I regret having said yes to that. It was quite an experience. And I say it only jokingly because it ended up being a really enlightening and fun experience for me, but one that I found really difficult to begin with. First of all, because I had left the book behind, and in order to record the audiobook, I had to approach it from a completely different perspective. Ironically, I had to immerse myself more in the emotion of the book, performing it for the audiobook, than I did while writing it. I felt while writing it that I could keep some distance from events which I was manipulating, essentially making things happen. In the audiobook, I was almost experiencing in the way that I suppose a method actor would experience. And so it made it much more difficult for me. And then also, you know, there's just the fact that I'm not a trained actor. So I did feel, at times, I did feel this sort of sense of self-doubt about whether or not I could do it. But in the end, it ended up being a really rewarding process and, you know, particularly fun to go into the Penguin Studios and record with Roy McMillan there.
We mentioned Windrush in passing there, and I remember back in the day chatting to Andrea Levy about recording the long song and trying to find the voices of our parents. How did you find the voices of your past?
That's a good question. I didn't realise that Andrea Levy had recorded the long song. Now, I must go and seek that out. I was very... I had a huge sense of trepidation about recording, in particular the accents in my novel, because I didn't want to get any Jamaican accents wrong. I'm the child of Jamaican immigrants, and we left Jamaica when I was 4. So the one thing I was very aware of was that if I produced any dodgy-sounding Jamaican accents, then I would be laughed out of the country the next time I tried to visit, and my parents might disown me. It's interesting what you said about Andrew Levy, because I tapped into the only source I have, which is my family, my grandparents, my parents, you know, the way I heard them speak growing up and the way I heard people around me speak growing up. I just tried to tap into that and also hope to forgive myself and to be forgiven if I got any of it wrong.
Now, one thing that we do miss if we download the audiobook version is the cover itself. Could you describe the embroidery on there?
Yes, the embroidery is based on an original piece of embroidery which was commissioned by Penguin from Scott Heron. And it is essentially an elaborate kind of bed of roses and skulls and bees and other Gothic imagery embroidered on a scarlet background, which I think really evokes the sense of richness and lushness, but also kind of simmering underlying terror and danger of the book as well.
And of course, it's now available in audio, making it accessible for a whole audience of blind and partially sighted people. Is that important to you?
Absolutely. I'm so delighted. First of all, I'm delighted to be doing this program and also delighted that the book is available in formats that can be accessible by blind and partially sighted people, you know, including many friends of mine who I know have accessed the book in audiobook form. So, yes, I couldn't be more delighted. And I hope that people who do listen to the audiobook will enjoy and appreciate it as well.
The Confessions of Franny Langton is available commercially. And Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, and it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
The Confessions of Franny Langton is now in the RNIB library in both audio and braille. And now, a return to Louise Hare, author of This Lovely City, Miss Aldridge Regrets and Harlem After Midnight, all available from RNIB Talking Books for the books of her life. Louise, was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
So I think a book that I loved in childhood, because I've always loved books that had sort of a quest or an adventure, and I've always loved fantasy fiction. And one of the first ones that I read is one of the Chronicles of Narnia, but perhaps one of the lesser known ones. It's called The Horse and His Boy by C.S. Lewis. And I think I just love this because it's an adventure. It's a boy and a talking horse who meets another talking horse and a girl, and they go on this adventure together. And I just found it so fun. And it's a book that I read. It was kind of a comfort read when I was a child. I haven't read it for some years, but yeah, definitely as a kid, it was one that I would go back to time and again.
In those days, far south in Kalorman, on a little creek of the sea, there lived a poor fisherman called Ashish. And with him there lived a boy, who called him father. The boy's name was Shasta. On most days, Ashish went out in his boat to fish in the morning, and in the afternoon he harnessed his donkey to a cart, and loaded the cart with fish, and went a mile or so southward to the village to sell it. If it had sold well, he would come home in a moderately good temper, and say nothing to Shasta. But if it had sold badly, he would find fault with him, and perhaps beat him. There was always something to find fault with, for Shasta had plenty of work to do, mending and washing the nets, cooking the supper, and cleaning the cottage in which they both lived. Shasta was not at all interested in anything that lay south of his home, because he had once or twice been to the village with Ashish, and he knew that there was nothing very interesting there. In the village he only met other men who were just like his father, men with long dirty robes and wooden shoes turned up at the toe, and turbans on their heads and beards, talking to one another very slowly about things that sounded dull. But he was very interested in everything that lay to the north, because no one ever went that way, and he was never allowed to go there himself. When he was sitting out of doors, mending the nets, and all alone, he would often look eagerly to the north. One could see nothing but a grassy slope running up to a level ridge, and beyond that the sky, with perhaps a few birds in it. Sometimes, if Ashish was there, Shasta would say, "Oh, my father, what is there beyond that hill?" And then, if the fisherman was in a bad temper, he would box Shasta's ears and tell him to attend to his work. Or if he was in a peaceable mood, he would say, "Oh, my son, do not allow your mind to be distracted by idle questions. For one of the poets has said, 'Application to business is the root of prosperity. But those who ask questions that do not concern them are steering the ship of folly toward the rock of indigence.'" Shasta thought that beyond the hill there must be some delightful secret which his father wished to hide from him. In reality, however, the fisherman talked like this because he didn't know what lay to the north. Neither did he care, He had a very practical mind.
That's Alex Jennings reading from The Horse and His Boy by C.S. Lewis, available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Yeah, so for my rainy day read, I would go for Fingersmith by Sarah Waters. And I just love this book because, A, she's a brilliant writer, and it really brings Victorian sort of London and the countryside when it leaves the city to life. There's an amazing moment in the middle of the book that I can't talk about because I don't want to ruin it for anyone who hasn't read it. But even knowing exactly what's going to happen, you can easily go and reread this book and just enjoy it. And sort of, I think as a writer, I love seeing how she puts all the pieces together, but it feels completely seamless.
Was called Christopher Lilly. The niece's name was Maud. They lived west of London, out Maidenhead way, near a village called Marlow, and in a house they called Briar. Gentleman's plan was to send me there alone by train in 2 days' time. He himself, he said, must stay in London for another week at least, do the old man's business over the bindings of his books. I didn't care much for the detail of my travelling down there and arriving at the house all on my own. I'd never been much further west before than the Cremorne Gardens, where I sometimes went with Mr. Ibbs's nephews to watch the dancing on a Saturday night. I saw the French girl cross the river on a wire from there and almost drop. That was something. They say she wore stockings. Her legs looked bare enough to me, though. But I recall standing on Battersea Bridge as she walked her rope and looking out past Hammersmith to all the countryside beyond it. That was just trees and hills and not a chimney or the spire of a church in sight. And, oh, that was a very chilling thing to see. If you'd said to me then that I would one day leave the borough with all my pals in it and Mrs. Suxby and Mr. Ibbs and go quite alone to a maid's place in a house the other side of those dark hills, I should have laughed in your face. But gentlemen said I must go soon in case the lady, Miss Lily, should spoil our plot by accidentally taking another girl to be a servant. The day after he came to Lance Street, he sat and wrote out a letter. He said he hoped she would pardon the liberty of his writing, but he'd been on a visit to his old nurse, that had been like a mother to him when he was a boy, and he'd found her quite demented with grief over the fate of her dead sister's daughter. Of course, the dead sister's daughter was meant to be me. The story was that I'd been maiding for a lady who was marrying and heading off for India and had lost my place, that I was looking out for another mistress but was meanwhile being tempted on every side to go to the bad, and that if only some soft-hearted lady would give me the chance of a situation far away from the evils of the city, and so on. I said, if she'll believe bouncers like those gentlemen, she must be even sillier than you first told us.
That's Rachel Atkins reading from Fingersmith by Sarah Waters, available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend.
Yes, so my recent read is a book called Erasure by Percival Everett. And the reason I picked this up was because I've just seen the film American Fiction, which is based on this book. And I love that film so much. I wanted to see how much of the book had translated into the film, especially bearing in mind that the book was actually written, so 20 years ago. And obviously the movie is set now. Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised to see that even there were a couple of my favourite lines from the film, which have come directly from the book. You know, there are definitely changes that have been made, but I thought it still kept the sort of the comedy element, the satire element that I enjoyed so much in the film.
Saws cut wood. They either rip with the grain or cut across it. A rip saw will slice smoothly along the grain, but chew up the wood if it goes against the grain. It is all in the geometry of the teeth, the shape, size, and set of them, how they lean away from the blade. Crosscut teeth are typically smaller than rip teeth. The large teeth of rip saws shave material away quickly, and there are deep gaps between them which allow shavings to fall away, keeping the saw from binding. Crosscut teeth make a wider path, are raked back and beveled to points. The points allow the crosscut saw to score and cleave the grain cleanly. I arrived in Washington to give a paper, for which I had only moderate affection, at a conference, a meeting of the Nouveau Roman Society. I decided to attend out of no great affinity for the organization or its members or its mission, but because my mother and sister still lived in D.C., and it had been 3 years since my last visit. My mother had wanted to meet me at the airport, but I refused to give her my flight information. For that matter, I also did not tell her at which hotel I'd be staying. My sister did not offer to pick me up. Lisa probably didn't hate me, her younger brother, but it became fairly clear rather early in our lives, and still, that she had little use for me. I was too flighty for her, lived in a swirl of abstracts, removed from the real world. While she had struggled through medical school, I had somehow, apparently, breezed through college without cracking a book. A falsehood, but a belief to which she held fast. While she was risking her life daily by crossing picket lines to offer poor women health care, which included abortions if they wanted, I was fishing, sawing wood, or writing dense, obscure novels, or teaching a bunch of green California intellects about Russian formalism. But if she was cool to me, she was frozen to my brother, the high-rolling plastic surgeon in Scottsdale, Arizona. Bill had a wife and 2 kids, but we all knew he was gay. Lisa didn't dislike Bill because of his sexuality, but because he practiced medicine for no reason other than the accumulation of great wealth.
That's Sean Kristen reading from Erasure by Percival Everett, available commercially. And Louise, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, you can always find another episode of Read On as a podcast. Well, over 350 episodes on your favourite podcast app. Just search for R&IB Read on Spotify, Google, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can email the show using radio@rnib.org.uk or find me on Twitter @talking_books.
Books and accessible reading on R&IB Connect Radio.